Be advised, I see midway up the World Trade Center tower, heavy black smoke coming out. Also, it seems like heavy damage to the upper portion of the building cave.
Thin Line Believers is a Christ-based outreach for the men and women who walk the thin line between good and evil, order and chaos. Our motto is, our service for His glory. To the police officers, veterans, firefighters, corrections, paramedics, dispatchers, and whoever else may join us, we are so glad you're here.
All right. Well, welcome back to Thin Line Believers podcast. It's Steve again this week, and this week I'm excited to bring a guest that I've been reaching out to and trying to get on the podcast for just a little bit here, and he's been so gracious to come and join us and take time out of his busy schedule. So today we have Jim Warner Wallace. He joins us, and Jim is a detective, a cold case homicide expert, and a Christian apologist. On top of that, Jim is a senior fellow at the Christian Colton Center for Christian Worldview and an adjunct professor of apologetics at Biola University in La Mirada, California. Did I butcher that at all, Jim?
No, that's more than close enough, right? I hate these long introductions, but yeah, good to be with you.
So Jim has also written a couple books. One that I have read somewhat recently, being Cold Case Christianity. He's got a couple others, God's Crime Scene and Forensics Faith. So again, thank you for being here. So in introducing you, you know, it would seem like you would be a longtime Christian, but your story is not that way, and actually is quite different. You know, from the prototypical story, either you were raised in the church or you had some event or trauma or some kind of valley low that brought you to Christ. I was wondering if you could talk to the guys and gals that tune in, how you came to be a Christian and kind of how that walk began for you.
Well, I wasn't raised in the church. I didn't have anyone in my family who was, a Christian, either practicing or otherwise. So I just wasn't raised that way. I think I had, my grandparents on my dad's side would probably at least have been raised in the South. They probably had exposure to it, but I never went to church. I never knew anybody who talked about Jesus, talked about Christianity. My mom was kind of raised as a cultural Catholic. And early on, I just made a decision that none of that stuff is true. And by the time I was about seven, I think my mom would have loved for us to continue to be kind of a cultural Catholic. You know, she divorced my dad when I was very, very young, so it's just the two of us. But I'll be honest with you, I just thought it was nonsense. Back in those days, in the 60s and 70s, we were just getting ready to land on the moon. We were, Star Trek, the first generation, was in its heyday. I mean, it's like this sense that all questions you might have, all kind of mysterious metaphysical questions you might have, they can be answered by science. And so there was just no reason for me to – I was not interested in it. And the few Christians I did know, even at work as a police officer, were – to be honest, did not seem to hold very well-examined views. I could ask them questions about the Bible. I could challenge them on a couple of things, and they were, for the most part, flat-footed. This is a group that, if you think about it, as police officers, we're typically evidentialists, right? I mean, you're going to have five reasons why you think this is the guy we should be setting up on our surveillance team, right? You got to have 10 reasons why you think this guy's good for your murder before you put this in front of a jury. We have to have reasons. And I just didn't think there were such things under the Christian worldview. And the few Christians that I knew didn't seem to know what those reasons would be, aside from they'd had an experience that for them demonstrated that Christianity was true. That's very common, right? I mean, this is also common, though. My dad remarried. He's not a believer either. But his second wife is Mormon. So I've got six half-brothers and sisters that were, started having kids in the 60s. And, so I've got three brothers, three sisters, all of whom were raised Mormon. And if you ask them why they're Mormons, because they were raised that way and they've had an experience that demonstrated for them, usually they'll say some movement of the Holy Spirit, some manifestation of burning in the bosom. Sometimes people used to say that, not so much anymore. that convinced them that the Book of Mormon was true, and
gotcha.
That Joseph Smith's a prophet of God. Well, I just figured, hey, that everyone says this, and
right.
I don't believe those guys either. So I just stayed out of it for the most part. But my wife was interested in like examining. You know, once we had kids, she was kind of like, well, do we take them to church? I mean, a lot of people take their kids to church. And here, our kids are getting older here. They're like, you know, first and second grade, kindergarten and second grade. So I was like, you know, should we be taking these kids to church? And so that's what really got me sitting in the pews for the first time. But I was about 35, and the pastor just piqued my interest in the person of Jesus enough to buy a Bible and take a look at it.
Just start digging in.
Yeah, start digging in. Really digging in from the perspective of not like, you know, I didn't trust what anybody had to say about him. I just said, what is the manuscript evidence? What do we have in history? Like, we're working a cold case. And that's
right.
what I, you know, did for the most part of my career is I've been working cold case homicides. And these are events in the past. I don't have access to the eyewitnesses sometimes because they've died. I mean, some of my cases are 35 years old. And I don't have access to those. Sometimes I don't even have access to the report writers because those guys have died too. Or
right.
they've, you know, not available. They don't remember. They had 50 cases that week and they don't remember what this, you know, so they aren't really much help to me. So we have to figure out what happened in the past based on manuscript evidence in my cold cases. Same thing I was trying to do, figuring out what happened in the past related to Jesus based on the manuscript evidence. So that's kind of the approach I took.
Yeah, and, you know, walk me through how that was for you. I mean, because coming from where you came from, I actually grew up Mormon as well. So me making that transition from Mormonism to true Christianity was quite the process, you know, for me.
Oh, I bet. It usually is.
Yeah, and I can only imagine coming from, you know, the non-belief, the complete non-belief of, you know, this is a hoax, this is a, you know, whatever some people call it, to where you are today. How did that look for you? I mean, internally, was there a struggle there, or was it more just the analytical part that brought you there?
Well, I have a friend named Lee Strobel who wrote a book called The Case for Christ. And his story, he was an investigative journalist. He had a law background. I think he's Harvard Law. And he was working for the Chicago Tribune when his wife became a Christian first. And so his whole approach was, hey, I don't think this is true, and I don't want my wife to be a Christian. So he was trying to prove his wife, Leslie, was wrong about what she believed about Christian. That was not my story. I was not trying to prove Susie wrong, my wife. She wasn't a Christian yet. I mean, we were both
right.
together 18 years before either one of us walked in that church. And, you know, I think she was far more receptive. I think she would have said that she believed there was a God. I wouldn't even have given you that.
Wow.
But I would have, you know, I would have gone to church as an atheist for her. My dad would do that now. My dad's been doing that for 40 years, going to ward, going to, you know, he'd be happy to come to my church, to go anywhere. He thinks it's a very useful delusion. By the way, my dad was a cop for 30 years before I was a cop.
Oh,
I took over a lot of his cases. My first cold cases were his unsolved.
Huh.
My son is now a cop after us. We all have the same name. So he's got a very similar skill set to me, and my son's got a very similar skill set to me. And he would have gone to church, my dad, and still would, because he thinks it serves a purpose, even though it's not true. And that's really where I was, too. This is fine. I'm happy to go. Don't think it's true, but if it does what you want it to do, I'm in.
Then so be it.
To go. So I was happy to go that way. So I was really rather neutral starting it. I just thought it was it's false. I'm not emotional about it. It's just – But as it turned out, the more I dug into it, the more I started to see the anecdotal things first. You know, when you talk to witnesses long enough, and I've talked to thousands, you probably, you know, I don't know if you know, familiar with this kind of work, but we talked to thousands of witnesses, and to be honest, I saw things in the Gospels that bothered me because they were such nonsense anecdotal things that and embarrassing things, and a lot of just a certain level of contradiction or apparent contradiction. We always have this in eyewitness accounts where you have two people say two different things, and you're both of no one's lying to you, but you got to figure out, how do I reconcile these two things that look like on their face they don't seem to agree? Of course they do, because you ask the follow-up questions. Now, I'm not going to be able to ask follow-up questions
right.
of these ancient documents, right, to kind of figure it out, you know. Because what happened, if you had two witnesses and one said that they spoke to one angel at the tomb and the other one said there were two angels at the tomb, at some point, if you're a good investigator, you're going to say, so tell me, let's go back to that tomb thing again. Tell me about, you said you spoke to an angel, so there's only one angel there? And that person's right. going to say, well, no, there were two, but I spoke to one of them. Okay, yeah. You're going to clear that up. But you can't ask follow-up questions of these documents. So when I first look at them, they look a lot like the kinds of eyewitness accounts I have to sift through before I get to go back and find those old witnesses from 35 years ago and ask a follow-up question. Right. So I thought, man, there's some stuff here that really kind of, like, I'm interested because, you know, it just doesn't mean anything at this point. But it does seem like there's the level of variation and the level we're reading through the book of Acts right now, my wife and I, we read every night, and mm-hmm. I think we're in chapter 18 right now. And if you just read through the book of Acts, you got to ask yourself, why does Luke include some of this meaningless information that is not necessary?
Right.
Because you could write it differently. I mean, it feels and looks like there's stuff in there that really has no purpose in the narrative if it's trying to deceive us. You
yeah.
know what I mean?
Yeah,
and
yeah,
you kind of
sure.
get a sense of this, just you get a sense intuitively, and there's no science to this. This is an art and a science. But if you talk to enough witnesses, all the stuff that these textual critics over the years would try to parse out and say, there's three authors here, you can't trust this, you can't trust that, they just never talk to enough witnesses to know that this is what they sound like. Mm-hmm. And as I did that in the Gospels, I became more and more interested and more confident that these might just be eyewitness accounts.
Right. Yeah. So was there a I guess a point in time, like a turning point, where that unbelief kind of switched to belief? Can you pinpoint a time during your investigative, you know, process of the Bible and of the Gospels and all that, where the switch kind of flipped for you?
Yeah, and people ask me that all the time, right? But the nature of the kinds of cases I work are not switch-flipping cases because mm-hmm. if they were, that switch would have flipped back 30 years ago and somebody would have taken this guy to jail.
Yeah.
But it didn't work
yeah,
that
true.
Way.
Yeah.
So we're stuck with this more obscure, circumstantial, cumulative case that I build
mm-hmm.
that we then go in front of a jury with. And along the way, I'm not always convinced that this is the right guy. You know, you might have two potential suspects in your case, and I've had cases where I'm working with an officer or a detective who's like, sure, what's this guy? And I'm like, I'm close.
Right.
But I'm not there, and if I'm not there yet, I don't think a jury's going to be there yet, so we're going to have to go a little further on this. And here's why. There's this other guy over here that looks equally good right now, and so these are cumulative cases, and at some point the weight becomes, okay, yeah, now I'm good. Yep, there's no other reason. I think we've gotten beyond any other reasonable explanation for these 18, 25 pieces of evidence. These
yeah.
things are best explained by this guy. So I get to that point where I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm because, you know, look, our guys aren't always going to confess.
Right.
You don't want to put someone in jail that you can't go to bed at night and say, there's no doubt in my mind he's the guy.
Right.
So we wait till I wait till I get to a point where that mountain is huge. And so that's what I did with this, is I got to a point where I was like, wow, it's not one piece didn't convince me. I call this death by a thousand paper cuts, right? You're in this,
right.
And each one of these little pieces of evidence is a paper cut, and by itself it's not much. But at some point I'm like, yeah, I told my wife, yeah, I've tested this now and tested this, and I've gone over and over again, and I think these are eyewitness accounts, and I think they are reliable. But I don't know what that tells us. I said, I still don't understand why. So I get this fact that, okay, Jesus of Nazareth, I trust he existed.
Mm-hmm.
And I now trust what these accounts tell me about his power.
Right.
And that puts me in a place where I'm like, wow, I'm no longer an atheist, I guess, because,
right.
or at least I'm no longer a naturalist, because a naturalist would say that miracles don't occur. So
right.
I'm in that camp now. But I still don't understand why, if God does exist, he would have to send a guy named Jesus who would die on a cross. So in other words, I had confidence in the data, but no understanding of the gospel.
Oh, okay.
And at that
yeah,
point is where I started to look at and say, okay, so now what? So, and I always say this, that if you look at the gospels for what they say about Jesus, you can eventually have confidence in the data, and that'll give you belief that. But once you look at the gospels and see what they say about you, now you're going to move to belief in, because until you know you need a Savior, You can have all the data in the world that says this guy's a savior, but so what?
Yeah.
So once you know you're in need, and you know he is the guy, well, now those two things click together, and I think that's really where I had. So I can tell you that that's a switch that does flip. That's a switch that when I got into you know Paul's letters and compared them to the Book of Acts to see where he is when he's writing these things, and you see him talk about the natural man in 1 Corinthians, you see him talk about how no one you know seeks God and how all of us are fallen in Romans, and you read Romans 7 and you go, man, this sounds just like me. I think he's writing to me. He could be writing to me personally. This sounds like my condition.
Right.
But that's something that you know, to be honest, that's not something that. And I always get this challenge. Look, no one's argued into the kingdom. Evidence doesn't. It's what God does. Well, no. I think that you're right. No one comes unless God calls them. So God has to do something in my heart before I'll even look at the evidence. But the manner in which the truth of Christianity is explained to me can be a number of ways. It could just be, hey, I had this experience. You can too. I got this relationship with Jesus. You could too. He's changed my life. He could change yours too. That is true for a lot of people. But that was not me.
Yeah.
I needed to know, hey, just like in the Book of Acts, every single person who shares the truth about Jesus in the Book of Acts really does not share it the way we do in churches around America today.
Oh, yeah.
They'll typically say, hey, there's this evidence from the Old Testament that points to the coming Messiah, and he's supposed to look like this, this, and this based on the Old Testament. You know that. And they'll quote from Isaiah, and they'll quote from different verses of the Old Testament. And then they'll say, well, guess what? Jesus came and fulfilled all that prophecy, and we saw it with our own eyes, and he demonstrated he was God by rising from the tomb.
Right.
That's a very evidential approach, and I just needed to have that approach before I could even consider the facts.
Yeah, no, that's really good. I mean, I have few friends who have come about that way, just in more analyzing, the stories and the documents and those kind of things. But it seems like a lot of Christians, at least today, come from the other side. So I wanted to bring some different tools to those who listen and to some of my friends who I know actually listen but aren't necessarily believers and aren't, Christians and don't have that relationship on maybe some different approaches of, of becoming a Christian or of realizing, the truths that are there that they try and debunk, right?
Yeah.
And so bringing in, your books and, your approach, once I started reading yours, a few of the guys really, hitting my heart of, they need to read this because, the conversations we've had or the things that they've said, this is good,
Well, I can tell you that I think we're wired as police officers slightly differently, right? I mean, number one, skepticism is your best friend. And I never want people to abandon their skepticism because the truth of the matter is that skepticism is what solves cases. If you talk to people and you believe everything everyone's talking to you about, no one goes to jail. What happens is at some point you say to yourself, this dude is a liar. And and it's that pursuit of finding out what he's lying about that opens the case up. So I get that. I mean, we are skeptical people, and that's okay. I think, as a matter of fact, there were lots of people who had doubt and skepticism that the evidence was powerful for them. And I'll bet your journey out of Mormonism involves you looking at the evidence related to the Book of Mormon, related to the history of the church, related to Joseph, and some of what happened in your heart over a period of time was that you learned truths that were persuasive for you.
Yeah.
Because if you trusted in the same way you got into Mormonism to get into a new system, you'd never really be sure that any of those, because let's face it, the two most popular answers for every single worldview are that I was raised in it and I had an experience. This is true in Buddhism. This is true in Islam. This is true in, it's true for so many people. Now, I'm not going to say that your own experience is not good evidence. It is.
Yeah.
It is. But it has to be tested. Because you might think
you saw
something, and then you find out after you test it, I misunderstood it, or I didn't see exactly what I thought I saw. So there are some things you have to test, and I think this actually can hold up to the test. I mean, we have a certain criteria. I don't trust witnesses. You get burned. Most of my cases end up on Dateline, and I do not want to be burned nationally in front of sometimes they come in early, and, I don't want to – I can't, get them out of the case. I can't – I can't say, okay, no, we're not going to do this on Dateline. No, they're already invested. So I'm stuck with this, and now we're in trial, and now I got some witnesses making me look like an idiot. So right. I have to test all of these witnesses, and that's what I did with the gospel authors, is I just said, hey, whatever criteria we're using in front of it. Now, look, most of your witnesses in trial are not going to make supernatural claims. I get that. So that's the one thing that if you're testing the gospels, you're going to say, well, then I get to this side, then he's walking on water, and I can't trust that. So now it's not reliable. Well, that comes down more to a bias against the supernatural than it does to a real critical analysis of the eyewitness. Yeah. So in every, if you took all the miracles out of the New Testament, took them all out, there isn't a single historian who wouldn't say that's a reliable account. Because it jives with the first century culture. It jives with the few facts that are in there that match history. It works. But there are supernatural parts. It will say, so what? So put the supernatural back in. So now you're out because there's – let's take a look at that for a second. We already, as an atheist, I believed in the supernatural, and I didn't even know it. Because I was somebody who believed in Big Bang cosmology, right? In other words, everything in the universe leaps into existence at one time in the ancient, distant past. All space, time, and matter have a beginning. Now think about that. All the science points to this, by the way. That's why the standard cosmological model for astrophysicists is still Big Bang cosmology, that everything, all space, time, and matter, begins in the distant past. Now, if that's the case, anything that begins requires a beginner. Now, what kind of cause could create all space, time, and matter? It's got to be something that's outside of space, time, and matter, because those things are not available until the universe begins. So now we're looking for a non-spatial, non-temporal, non-material first cause. And
something
that cause
probably,
has to be eternal itself, or you're going to have to explain where it came from. And cosmologists all agree on this. They're looking at, they'll say, oh, well, it's a multiverse generator. What's it made of? It can't be made of space, time, or matter. Those things don't exist, and that's where the trouble begins. Well, I got to kind of redefine what nothing is. No, we're saying that that everything came from nothing, and that requires something you'd have to at least call extra natural, because it's not made of a space, time, or matter. Those are the things that make up nature. So it's at least extra natural, and if it's a personal being, well, then the biggest miracle in all of Scripture is Genesis 1.
Yeah,
and if there's something out there that can create everything in the universe from nothing, I'm guessing that walking on water is small potatoes.
Yeah, that's
nothing. So we have to kind of open our mind. And I already had, really, if I examine my own worldview, I've already committed to the idea that there was something outside of space, time, and matter that was a first cause. Well, why couldn't that first cause do other things? That's the whole examination here, is to determine if there's a first cause of the universe, it's not just an impersonal force. Is the first cause personal? Because if it's personal, now we're getting dangerously close to the kinds of descriptions of deity that we see in the New and Old Testament.
Right.
So we have to kind of – so that's that, to me, it helps me to at least open my mind to the possibilities, the reasonable inferences.
Yeah. Exactly.
So that's where,
good. Yeah.
That
really
helpful.
Could have happened. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. So that's one of the things that – so again, if you just make sure as you're examining this that you're not holding on to this bias against the supernatural that really isn't warranted, even if you hold an atheistic view of the universe, you'd have to admit there's at least one cause, one force out there that is outside of what we typically refer to as nature. And then you're stuck. So now the only question is there a book that might accurately describe that first cause?
Right.
And don't be surprised then if that first cause is able to act supernaturally in the course of history, because it's been doing that all along. The first event of history was a supernatural act.
Yeah, exactly.
So.
Wow. No, that's really good. So I guess in closing, I mean, that got everything that I was hoping to get to pass on to these guys, the specific ones that I'm thinking about in my mind. And just kind of an approach, and maybe to get them thinking.
Well, I mean, I would say this: do not allow. I mean, retain. Again, skepticism can be your best friend. In some ways, situational awareness, all the things we talk about, and avoiding danger, and avoiding. But these things require a certain amount of innate amount of skepticism. It will help you. It'll serve you well. The question is will it control you? And because that's the case, you know, you're not going to ever trust anybody you'd eventually marry, because let's face it, a lot of weddings, a lot of marriages, there are people who are trying to take advantage of others. At some point, you're going to have to move beyond your skepticism to find your mate. Well, the same is true when you find a worldview. You have to, at some point, you have to move beyond your skepticism, or you'll be stuck looping in your skepticism. So I would think that, you know, I think you could use the skills that I've developed, that we all develop as detectives, that you could use those skills and end up right here. The question is whether you're willing to lay down your bias against the supernatural.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest thing right there.
Yeah. It is.
So I understand. Are you still doing a weekly show as well?
Yeah. So I, you know, if you want to call it that. So I've always done podcasts every week, and then I got a call from NRB Network to say, hey, would you be willing to throw a webcam on your podcast? Which, you know, at first it sounded like a good idea, you know, but
right.
Then I realized that, you know, when you do your podcast, you're just throwing on a mic. You could do that in your pajamas. You can do that in
your
shorts.
Yeah, pretty much. Right.
Yeah, now you want a camera on? So I looked at my room. My office was a mess. You know, so I'm like, I got to clean my office every week. So yeah. So what we do is we just have a 35-millimeter, not 35, it's digital camera now. Everything's digital. It's like the old-fashioned 35 mils that we put on the desk, and we just shoot this thing. You know, it's a talking head kind of a show. But the idea is that we are going to go through some of the evidences, and although I don't think it's produced all that well, I mean, it's just one person doing it, and I post-edit it with some graphics, not much to it. But what people seem to be drawn to is the content, right? If we're talking about the issues that are important to you or that you've had questions about, well, then I think we have a chance to gain an audience, and I think what's happened here. You know, it's filmed okay, but I'm not as impressed with the. I spend more time on the content than I actually can on the appearance of it. So,
can you let the guys and gals know the name of that and where they can find it?
Yeah, so it's I've got on our website, which is coldcasechristianity.com. You'll see a tab for the TV show. So just hit that, and you can watch it on NRB. But also, we have the entire show archived on YouTube. So we've got like 112 or something episodes of this show for the last 5 years. So you can watch all of them on YouTube. And you'll see as you go back, the further you go back, the goofier it looks, right? I mean, the further you go back, the worse the camera. I mean, I first started off with just a web camera and moved on from there. So you'll see that it gets a little better in terms of quality as it goes, but you'll see lots of different iterations of this. But it really is our weekly podcast that has been turned into a 28-minute television show.
Sounds good. Well, tune in to that and watch some of those. I've watched a couple and pick up a couple of Jim's books. I have gotten through Cold Case Christianity so far, and I plan on reading the other two. Jim, we appreciate you taking the time and joining us and, you know, taking the time out of your schedule to be here.
No, so glad to be here. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. All right, guys, we will we'll get back with you here in the next week, and we'll have some good things coming. In the meantime, be blessed, and we'll talk to you later. Okay. We're off.
That sounds really good.
Yeah, no, I think that was great. It was exactly what I was hoping to get with you on, just kind of that different approach and that more evidentiary approach that I hope can hit some people who just can't wrap their minds around it otherwise.
Oh, listen, I'm with you. It's so true, right? I mean, this is and everyone's different, you know. Everyone's got a different way in.
Yeah.
But I think that cops, for the most part, are – and I never really did this to make cops my audience. I mean, I knew that there would be some out there. But it wasn't like I was just writing to cops. But I kind of figured that pretty much everybody is watching cop shows. So even if you're not talking to that audience specifically – there's a good chance you'll be talking to somebody who resonates with or who likes that or who, you know.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what we were hoping for. But anyway, I appreciate you letting me have it. Come on.
Yeah,
it's
of course.
All good.
All right.
All right,
well,
brother.
Thanks, Jim. I appreciate
yep,
your time.
Yep, for sure. Yep. Let's
all right.
And let me know when you post it and where you post it, and I'll promote it. Okay?
Okay. Sounds good. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, man. All right. Bye.
All right. Bye.